Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You once again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Well, good evening. I'd like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I am from Sarasota, Florida. And I'm also an adult survivor of child abuse. Tonight is Wednesday, November 15th, 2022. This is scan number 3052. We've done more shows than that, a lot of shows on NASCA. The type of show we have tonight is what we call Survivor Professional Night. It's an open mic forum where we will have a special guest host, who is also a survivor professional, come to lead us in conversation. And we are very fortunate to have Sheree White from Covington, Tennessee, with us this evening. I'll tell you a little bit more about Sheree in a few minutes. But before we kick off the show, I want to tell you a little bit more about NASCA and NASCA's mission. As you know, NASCA is all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, and recovery. If you have an interest in becoming involved with NASCA, a great way to do that is to go on our website, which is www.nasca, which is NASCA.org. On the front page, you'll learn a little bit more about NASCA, and there are many volunteer opportunities and how to get involved. Another way is just to call into the show tonight, be on the panel. And the number to do so is area code 646-595-2118. And all you have to do is call in. And my co-host this evening, Bill Murray, also our founder and president of NASCA, is my co-host. He'll greet you on our back line and welcome you into the show. And there's no experience necessary. You can call in and become a member of the panel without any experience. It's a curiosity to get involved. So let me tell you a bit more about NASCA's mission, because we have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect, and we do so with only two goals. The first goal is educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts, showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. The second goal, offering hope and healing through many paths, providing many services to adults survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, recovery. So we invite you to become involved and get involved in NASCA, become a member of our NASCA family. There is no sign up. There is no fee. All you have to do is express an interest to join and become a member, and you are. If you'd like to, again, become involved in our panel tonight, the number for that is 646-595-2118. I'll tell you a bit more about our show tonight. Our guest, as I mentioned, is Sheree White from Covington, Tennessee. Sheree's amazing. I've had the opportunity to be on the show with Sheree many times, and I always learn something new. And she has so much to bring to the table. Specifically, she is an anti-bullying advocate. And within her advocacy, she has offered 3 books, and she uses her own personal story of being bullied and gaslighted to help those enduring the same abuse today. A little bit about Sheree. In the 6th grade, she began a long lesson in the human predator-prey dynamic and a battle for her dignity, safety, and her very soul. The physical beatings, name-calling, and abuse. Sheree was a victim of what is called polyvictimization. In just 6 months of this treatment, she went from being a kid who always made the honor roll to an angry and bitter girl who made only C's and D's. Who could concentrate on schoolwork, she asks. Sheree attempted suicide at the age of 14. Because I felt powerless, I began to bully those who were even weaker than me in attempts to grab back some of my power, she shares. So on these episodes, these survivor professional evenings and shows, we welcome various co-hosts, just like Sheree, survivor professionals who will assist in fielding questions and lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. So their trauma-informed perspectives, such as Sheree's, as survivor professionals, will help her guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. So everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. So without further ado, I want to thank Bill for trailing me this evening. And Sheree, I'm going to unmute both of your mics if my finger will work. And Sheree, just welcome you and Bill into the show. And Sheree, it's so nice to have you here this evening. Thank you for being on.
You're very welcome, and thank you for having me.
Oh, of course. It's our pleasure. So, you know, it is, I know, you know, I've been on the show several times. I always learn so many new things, but I'm wondering if you have any, you know, topics around, you know, around bullying in mind. And I guess I'm thinking specifically of the holidays coming up and how some of those dynamics play, you know, within this topic. So I'll hand it over to you, but I do have my holidays on the top of my mind.
Okay. Well, I do know that a lot of people experience family bullying. Now, that's the type of bullying I never experienced, and I'm blessed for that. You know, I came from a great family. I have nothing but wonderful memories of childhood Christmases and Thanksgiving. You know, we all got along, and, you know, maybe that's the reason I was bullied in school, because I come from, you know, such a great family. And, you know, we just got along so well. We were a close-knit family where everyone was accepted and loved. But, you know, lately I've heard stories of people who were bullied in their own family. And sadly, that's not that uncommon. And so for targets of family bullying, you know, the holidays can be a stressful time.
You know, there was bullying within my family of origin. I mean, now that I look back, you know, I think there was, it's really hard to sort of delineate the, you know, all the different types of maltreatment. But when I got married, I experienced an all new different form of bullying from my in-laws. And, you know, I've learned, yeah, that entrances and exits, you know, of people within a family unit, you know, are great puzzles of duress you know, they're change agents, basically, and they subject a lot of stress, additions and subtractions. So when I think about that and I think about, you know, being married and coming into this family as an addition, really experienced a whole new different, form of maltreatment. And it was horribly, it was very, very, very hurtful, not painful. It was very abusive. And I felt very,
right.
as an outsider coming in, I felt, well, that I did not have any power to do anything to stand up to the treatment. I thought that it was something I had to endure, especially because the mother, my mother-in-law and my sister-in-law were ganging up on me together. So it was very, very, very hard. I did feel very, very powerless. So I think when I think of holidays and family dynamics and bullying, that's what comes to mind for me is, and, those that the additions and the families and some of those dynamics. So I just wanted to share that with you. And I wish I knew you then as I was going through all this as a newlywed. It was because, I didn't have the tools or knowledge that I have now to really, navigate the situation.
Right. And, in-law bullying is especially common. And I can certainly relate to in-law bullying from my first marriage. There were a couple of times where my first husband, who was an only child, he and his parents would kind of gang up on me from time to time. But once I finally set my foot down and told my now ex-husband, how much less of a man he was not to at least stand up for his wife, not in an abusive way. I never wanted him to turn against his parents, but he didn't even speak in my behalf. So that was pretty hurtful. Of course, he really was not the type to stand up for himself, much less for anybody else. But a lot of times he would join his parents, and that happens a lot, unfortunately. Instead of welcoming the new family member into the family, anytime there is a new marriage, a lot of times the family will exclude that person, or they get downright verbally abusive. So, it happened. Now I get along with them a lot better now that he and I are now divorced. But there was a couple of times that I could think of. Now, thank goodness that we lived 200 miles away from his family, so that didn't happen often, but there were a couple of times that it did happen when we would go see his family.
And you had talked in previous shows about addressing the bullying by really fighting back and really standing up and not taking it. Or
right.
completely in the situation, right? Getting yourself out of that bad environment. And I think, fighting back and setting boundaries, there's some alignment there, I think. When it's your own family bullying, if you're the one coming in, I'm just using your example with you and your husband, then he should be, he should have set some boundaries up front, right, by standing up for you. But when you don't
right.
do that, then escalate. It's hard to leave a situation if you're married, right? It can be done, but it's hard. Yeah.
And not only that, but sometimes it can make the like my husband, for instance, it forces them to have to choose between his wife, or if it's a husband being bullied by the wife's family, it forces the wife to have to choose between, the other spouse has to choose between their spouse and their family, and that's not yeah. fair to them either.
No.
And naturally, it's a hard choice to make. But, you know, my experience did get better because once I decided to leave my first husband, I'm the one that left, and I'm the one that filed for divorce. Once that happened, I think my in-laws, I guess they respected me a lot better because I never got that treatment again. Once I decided to walk away from the marriage, you know, they treated me pretty well. And of course, I don't know if it was because, you know, they were glad that I left or honestly, I don't think they were because I left their son, but nevertheless, they treated me a lot better once I walked away from the marriage.
So maybe they respected you just taking some sort of action to say, not doing this.
Right.
Well, you know, that's doing something, isn't it? It's taking a stand.
Yes. Yeah, I took a stand because, I mean, the marriage, it wasn't a good marriage. And in order to preserve my own sanity, you know, I had to get out and I had to take the kids and leave. Now,
yeah.
In your case, when you were bullied by your in-laws, did your husband, did he speak in your behalf or... Did he just not get involved, or did he join his family in bullying you?
He did not stand up for me, and he did not get involved. He would just sort of silently, you know, and passively, I guess, whine really with his family. And
but he didn't join them in putting you down.
Yeah, by not really standing up to it. So he didn't really join in he didn't take an active role, but he took a passive role, if that
right.
makes sense. It was like he was afraid to stand up to them. So he just...
Right.
And I felt like I lost
well,
him. It was like another layer of maltreatment when, you know, you're just alone, you know, when your spouse won't defend you.
Right. Right.
So,
and
it was,
you know,
yeah,
it was probably, I'm sure he didn't like the way they were treating you, but I think you felt pulled. And that's what happens when a new in-law is being bullied, is the spouse feels torn between his spouse and his family. And it's understandable because you love your spouse, but you love your family too. And it's just a hard situation to be in. Granted, it doesn't excuse his passivity. I mean, he still should have spoken up in your behalf, not abusively, but lovingly to his family, spoke up in your behalf.
Well, yeah, he should have. And I think now, you know, the years and years have gone by, and I've done the work, you know, and I've gone to recovery myself. You know, I can see more of the bigger picture and really some of the reasons that he, you know, remained passive. And I, you know, I now, there was a lot of financial abuse and, you know, I think he was afraid to, they had a family business on the side. I think there were a lot of, there was a lot of abuse within the family, and I think his reaction to their bullying of me was just, you know, he was also frozen in, I think, being, you know, all the different nuances that go on in a family of, you know, where there, you know, family of origin is disruptive and there's abuse within it, you know, emotional abuse, monetary, you know, financial abuse. I mean, there was now I can see a bigger picture, right? And he obviously right. was stuck in a pattern and didn't know how to break it. You know?
Right.
So, I mean, I'm not making excuses, but I think I can now just have understand. And now, obviously, we've both done a lot of work and gone into healing, the healing and recovery process, and things have definitely changed. And we wouldn't, you know, we would handle that type of a dynamic if you rewind 25 years a lot differently, but we didn't have those skills yet or that,
right.
that knowledge.
Right. And I can remember my uncle years ago married a lady with two girls. And I remember hearing stories. They would go to Delaware to visit his wife's family. And there was favoritism between the girls. The oldest girl basically got treated like crap by her mother's side of the family, and they doted on the baby girl. I remember hearing my uncle talk about one Christmas, they all went to see my aunt's family, and they bought all of these Christmas presents for the younger girl, and the older girl maybe got maybe one present, and, you know, it was some used, you could tell it wasn't bought, it was used. And they gave the older girl one present, and it was something used, like a hand-me-down. And then they showered her younger sister with all of these nice new presents. And the younger sister was just living it up, while the older sister was sitting in the corner just feeling really, really bad. And the favoritism was just in your face. And I remember my uncle telling my grandmother about it and overhearing it, and it really made me feel really bad for the older girl.
Horrible.
And I think the older girl, I think, was about 10, 11 years old. And the younger girl, the one that was favored, she was maybe 6, but it like I said, it just really broke my heart for her, for the one that, because, I mean, this little girl just got a room full of presents, while the older sister only got one present, and she opened it, and it was a hand-me-down. It was a used.
Aww.
It was used, and it just really broke my heart for her. And she was only 11 years old, the older sister. So can you imagine what that does to a child?
Yeah, I mean, I can't imagine what that does to a child, and it is very, very damaging, extremely damaging. I think it's also
right.
I think, you know, if a child, the younger child is old enough to, you know, be discerning, I think it's them both.
Right. Well, they're both grown now. And the older, the younger girl has gone on to become a narcissist pretty much. And
yeah.
the older girl, she's still not right. You know, she's very damaged, and you can tell it in her social interactions that she's very damaged. And she didn't have a lot of friends, still doesn't. But the younger girl, the one that was lavished, that the family of her mother lavished all of this attention on and all of these gifts, she went on to become a narcissist. She always used, like, superficial charm to draw people to her. She's very charming and basically knows what to say, you know, says the right things, does the right things, you know where I'm going with this. And she turns out to be a narcissist. Of course, you know, her life, her life's gone down the tubes too, but just in a different way. But the oldest girl, she has no self-esteem. She's broken. And it just really, it breaks my heart for both of them, really.
Yeah, because they're both impacted in very different ways.
Right.
So we have actually, my co-host, Bill Murray, who you know, have another caller, Kathy, and so I'd like to go down the panel and just see, you know, Bill, I'll start with you, if you have any, you know, questions or comments for Sheree about our topic this evening.
You know, the thing about family bullying, I didn't have a lot of experience in that, although I did in the sense that my sister married into a family which did not like my mother, and they kind of played it out on my sister. And that was really unfair. You know, it transmitted into them being unfair to me, but I understood where it was coming from. And although I didn't know it personally, it still hurt. You know, it still hurt. But my bullying experience was in school, so it wasn't really with the family so much. But anyway, yeah, so Kathy was telling me she wants to comment about family bullying, too.
Oh, well, Kathy, please. You're on Sheree.
Hi, Sheree. I was listening, and I could so relate. My second marriage, my son was 8, we met, 8 to 10, and we had another child, and his family was trying to do the same thing, inviting the husband and the kid, and I'm like, you know, not me and Stephen, the other, my son, and I put my foot down. I wouldn't have it. I said, no, you know, that's just not going to happen. If you go somewhere, I can go with you, especially if it's family. You're not going to exclude us that way. I wouldn't allow
that.
And it went 20 years when he did not. In fact, he did it rather subtly. He didn't really bully and stand back up to them, but one of the family had gotten an invitation, and he simply told a wedding planned, and he simply told his sister, if my wife's name is not on the invitation, don't send it, because they had every intention of it, you know. And it took 20 years for one of the family members, because I missed not having the cousins, and, you know, I did. But it was definitely a strength that I didn't know I'd need, you know, in a marriage. I didn't know that chisel would peak its ugly head. But and you're absolutely right when you're speaking about the two children, and I was thinking about what would or could have happened had I allowed that favoritism to be blatant to the other child, how it would have affected my, you know. Anyway, it was great.
Wow.
And they're both grown, healthy, well-adjusted men. And I also now know some of the extended family that, you know, came back into our lives. But it's rough. It is definitely rough.
Absolutely. And I commend you for taking the initiative and standing up to these people.
It wasn't that easy. We had went to counseling. As a matter of fact, during that counseling, which had basically nothing to do with child abuse, but I did bring it up, and kind of as if it was no big deal. And the counselors go, well, you know, it probably causes you, because I may have reacted a little stronger emotionally than perhaps most people would have. But I have no regrets for standing up, like you said. I think it was the healthiest thing for the family.
Right. Well, you know, after 20 years of putting up with that, you know, you tend to, it's normal to come on a bit strong when you finally set your foot down.
I didn't put up with it for 20 years. That only lasted a couple of months. And then they were cut out of our life for 20 years. And then someone
oh,
in the family. Yeah, it was the opposite. I didn't put up with it. You know, it took him a few months, really, but it was stressful. It wasn't easy to stand up to it. I didn't know if the marriage was going to last, but I can tell you how it wasn't going to last. It wasn't going to last as we were separate entity in their family. That would no longer be a marriage, so that, you know, it wouldn't
right.
grow.
And I commend your husband for standing up for you guys.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, and it was rough on him. He was very close. But it was 20 years later when one of the, you know, by then the kids were grown, you know, came back into our life and reconnected the past few years of his life, which was wonderful. I was really happy about that because he passed away, and at least he had, you know, 5 or 6 years, maybe more, I'd have to think about it, of connection, you know. But it wasn't without me.
Oh, that's a blessing.
And it wasn't without
me. That's a blessing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a blessing. I'm glad that he was able to connect with the family again. Well, the both of you were able to connect with the family again before it was too late.
I showed courage for one of the – three of us were pregnant at the same time, and one of the mothers came out. The head bitch didn't come out, okay? In fact, I never did speak to her. I didn't miss her at all. But some of the other family members, you know, they reached out and got real close. In fact, we just had the 4th of July picnic here. You know, it was great. So.
Well, I am so happy for you.
But it's tough. It's tough. Family's tough, you know.
It is.
You know what?
And I'm so
glad. Oops.
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry.
I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Finish up your thought there, please.
It's okay.
I was thinking while you were telling the story about the two girls of a situation that was similar with me. Of course, I didn't have any brothers. I had a sister. She was a year apart, but we both got presents. But, you know, we were kind of middle class. So the quality of the presents we got, well, they were okay. They weren't always up to snuff as compared to, say, my aunt's kids. My mother's sister had children who were kind of given a lot of advantages. And she had two girls and a boy. The boy was maybe 6 or 8 years older than me. And he was a bigger person body-wise. You know, his chest was big and so forth. And they kept giving me his hand-me-downs, which were lovely, because he was taken to, you know, Brooks Brothers and very nice stores and so forth to get all his stuff. But they hung in my closet forever because I could never fit into them. I was never going to be that big. Yet they brought him into the house and put him in my closet. And every time I opened the closet, I looked at him. I went, geez, I wish I had clothing like this that I could actually wear. I remember that. You know, so that's kind of a similar example to how it feels. And this happened over and over with different, you know, different things. But since I had no brother, I related it with him. And, you know, he eventually went to Portsmouth Priory and Harvard and Michigan State for a law degree, and he got the best of the best, you know. And my parents,
right.
once I didn't do too well in freshman year of college, they stopped paying for it. And I had to scrape my way through college to two different colleges. Why what, hon? Why what?
Yeah, I completely understand. I mean, that would kind of make you feel bad. But now that you look back, you know, you can look back and say, hey, I did it, you know?
I don't know if I did or not.
Right.
I don't know. But anyway.
You know, you scraped your way through college, and you eventually made it, right?
I didn't finish college, no.
Okay.
I went to the University of Toronto for basically 2.5 years, and I drank there. That's how I learned how to drink there. And then I left college, and I went back to New York, and I bummed around for a while. And then I decided I was going to this time I was going to go to college for something I liked. So I went for film and TV and journalism to NYU. And I actually did very well, but I left NYU a few credits short of a degree because to me, I mean, I was telling myself, it doesn't matter if you have a degree or not, you know. And I was like, I don't know. I cheated myself, kind of.
But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't have a college degree, and they dive into their passion, you know, the thing that they love to do the most, and they end up just millionaires. So
yeah,
sometimes,
well,
you know, I mean, an education is important, and I would never downrate an education. It's very important, but it doesn't determine your education level doesn't determine whether you're going to make it or not.
In my case, my career went backwards because I started out having done very well. I was like the bright star of NYU, that class anyway, that year. And it went backwards. And I think the biggest reason it went backwards is because I realized that I was a drunk and a drug addict. And
right.
When I was about 30, I started to get sober when I was about 30, and that just, it was really, I couldn't work. That point, so
right.
I went backwards. But anyway, and I didn't use my journalism at all until NASCA, really. So
right, and you developed a good, organization. So
I hope so. Yeah.
Well, you did. You're helping a lot of people.
You did. You did, Bill.
Thank
and
you. Okay,
sometimes
thank
success
you.
Isn't measured in dollars. It's measured in there's a lot of value.
Right.
In other ways.
Yeah,
that
he's
you reach
definitely making an impact.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with dollars, though, and it wasn't intended to be. You know.
Right.
But it was intended to be kind of a. I feel like in a lot of my advocacy work and outside of this issue. I've done a lot of community building, you know, and that's kind of what NASCA is too, but specific communities, you know, and I've done very well in that respect, but none of them paid me anything.
Right.
I'm sorry I interrupted with that story. I didn't mean to do that, but, you know, I don't have a lot of bullying experience. When I was in high school, if I saw somebody being bullied, because people stayed away from me. I was too angry. They could tell. And I was an abused child who was pissed off that he'd been abused and didn't want anybody to call me a faggot or anything like that. But, you know, the guy that abused me was a male, and I was always afraid I would be pointed out. So I was hypersensitive to that, and that made me hypersensitive to other people being called names and so forth. And
right.
What I did about it was I defended them, not me, but them. I would go into the middle of an argument or into the middle of a bullying center, even fights. I'd get into fights with the bully because the person
right.
who was bullying was too weak. You know, and
we needed somebody like you in our school.
Yeah. Well.
I needed somebody like you in my school.
Uh-huh.
But, I'm so proud of you for standing up for somebody that could not stand up for themselves. And I think that
oh,
is
yeah.
so important. When somebody is being bullied, they need somebody like you to speak for them because bullying can be so terrifying that it paralyzes you. You can't move. You can't speak.
That's right.
And eventually I got out of that and I started standing up for myself. But by that time, it was too late. You know, I had let the bullying go on for too long without standing up for myself. And once I started to put my foot down, the bullying and the labels that were stuck to me, by the time I stood up for myself, it had all calcified or become ironclad. So no matter what I did, And I got into a lot of fights. And I won a lot of fights, but I lost a few, too. It didn't make a dent. It only made them angrier and more so want to get back at me.
Yeah. Yeah. Retaliate, yeah. Well,
you know, you'd fight one person, and then you'd have five of their friends wanting to jump you.
Yeah. Oh, no, that's terrible.
But I think there's a good, you know, there's something is emerging, at least as I'm listening to the conversation, and that is, you know, taking a stand and setting boundaries can have a powerful effect, you know, that transcends this, you know, the one-on-one, you know, with Bill standing up and, you know, that sets a boundary as well and puts people on notice. It just sounds like you're account, Sherry, and I know, you know, I've heard your story when you were bullied in school. There was no one that took that stand. And I'm just thinking about in family systems, you know, if one person takes a stand against bullying, you know, and sets that boundary, you know, that's the start of changing that pattern. I don't know if I'm incorrect, but I'm looking at, you know, my own family patterns and bullying within my own family of origin and then bullying in the family I married into. Nobody took a stand. Nobody pulled the Bill Murray, you know, nobody took a stand and these patterns just went on and on and on.
Well, right.
I warned people, if you cross this boundary, you're going to have to deal with me. You know, I did set boundaries and I told them, this is a boundary, you know. You're at risk. You're at risk of getting into it with me if you keep going. And most of them backed down. You know, I remember one story about a kid that, you know, I was in a boarding school in high school, and one kid came back from, I think it was Christmas time, with a couple of pairs of pants that were these newfangled things called bell bottoms. And one of the bell bottom pants was, we weren't allowed to wear jeans, so he had a yellow and orange pair of bell bottoms, like a plaid kind of, and another, a blue plaid. You know, she had two pairs, and he wore one of them to class one day, and he got called names. He got called, you know, fag and fairy and stuff, and that really bothered me. So I didn't say anything then, but in the break till the next class, I asked him, did you only get the one pair, or did you get a second? He said, I got two. I said, let's go up to your room, and we went up there, and I took his other pair of pants and put them on, and we went back to the second class, and believe me, nobody said a thing. Because they knew that was my – I didn't have to say anything. They knew who I was and what would happen to them if they crossed a line like that with me or again with him. Now, I don't know if he was gay or not. He may have been. I don't know. But, you know, I just didn't like people taking advantage of people who they felt were weaker and couldn't stand up for themselves. So I was a surrogate, you know. And believe me, I wore those – pants for the rest of the day, and nobody said a word about bell bottoms ever again.
Right. Yeah, you must have gone to school in the 80s, because anybody that wore bell bottoms was made fun of.
I was in the 60s and 70s, but thank you very much. I was in the late
60s. Oh, my gosh, I thought bell bottoms were in back then.
Well, they were if you were a hippie. But we weren't hippies. We couldn't wear jeans or anything like that. And nobody did. So that we was a farming community and a coal mining community and near Pittsburgh. It was a Pittsburgh community. So bell bottoms took a while to get in. The hippies were wearing them back east, and they were all jeans and stuff. But these were dress pants,
gotcha.
And that was it had to be around maybe 1970. Might have been juniors. I graduated in 71.
Right. Well, I know the bell bottoms were very much in back in the 70s, and it was, you know, in fact, they were a huge fad. My mother wore them. My dad wore them.
Yeah. My mom and dad were in their 50s and stuff. They didn't wear anything like that, and they didn't allow me to either.
Right.
I'm sorry, Penelope, did I
step on you there?
Not at all. No, I'm in, you know, this is a great conversation. I mean, I'm thinking that bell bottoms were in the 70s. From my recollection, I'm 50, so I was kind of going and leaving, I don't know, elementary school, so I can't really remember the fashion. But 80s, I remember everything became very tapered at the leg. So that's my recollection.
Right.
Right. And, you know,
too, I remember that. Go ahead.
You know, by the way, you know, back in the 80s was when I was in junior high and high school and being bullied. A lot of times when you're bullied, you use clothes to make you feel better. I know I did. We were an upper middle class family during the 80s. And I would, of course, I was still expected to work, you know, a part-time job to buy my clothes in high school. And I remember getting a nice job at a Captain D's that had just opened in my area. And I would take my paychecks and go buy my school clothes. And I remember going to, you know, places like the mall, Maurice's, Dillard's to buy my clothes because I felt so bad about myself. I felt like I had to look like a fashionista in order to feel good about myself. And it certainly didn't make the bullying go away. For a lot of reasons, it made the bullying actually worse. You know, the fact that I was trying to look my best, and I guess a lot of my classmates felt like I was trying to outshine them some way, but it wasn't about outshining anybody. It was about making myself feel better about myself, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. The clothes shopping, wearing high name brands and high fashion stuff. You know, in the 80s, especially the late 80s, you know, L.A. Gears were high-dollar shoes, Reebok, Guess jeans, and I wore a lot of name brand stuff just so I could feel better about myself.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I wore makeup, a lot of dresses, high heels. And that was for me. It wasn't for their benefit. But, you know, that seemed to, you know, spark their resentment. And the bullying got a lot worse.
Huh. Wow.
Wow, that's horrible.
It was. It really was. You know, like I said in my bio, it was the worst 6 years of my life. And it's a time that I'm glad that has passed. But at the same time, it made me who I am today. It made me a lot stronger, and it gave me the will to reach out to people who are going through the same thing today that I went through years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, no one ever taught me how to dress. They didn't teach me an awful lot of stuff. I didn't know even how to tuck a shirt in. I didn't know until years later, you know. And I figured out that the reason I looked kind of funky in a mirror was that everything was kind of sideways. You know, I just sort of crammed it in, and I didn't pay attention to where it went. And that was just common. That's kind of thing. Yeah. I was a square. I was a four-eye square, and I had been brought up in a very conservative home, but didn't feel conservative. I was extremely creative, but I couldn't get it out. Couldn't find places to, other than singing, I couldn't find ways to express my creativity. And my parents were not helpful. They were actually the opposite. And I guess I was. That was all part of my, still feel it, you know, my frustration at having missed a lot of my life.
you know, kind of.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the only way I was able, when you're bullied, you know, it kills a lot of your dating prospects.
Okay.
Anytime you're bullied and labeled and marginalized, it doesn't just kill your prospects for friendship, for new friendships. It kills your dating prospects as well. Nobody wants to date the person that's labeled a wimp or a slut or any, you know, things like that. So what I did was I would date people that outside of my school, and that's how I got around that. Or I would make friends with people that didn't go to school, my age, but didn't go to school with me. I dated, when I was in high school, I dated people of guys that were college age that didn't go to my school, that didn't know about my reputation, and that I didn't have a history with. So in that, I was able to get around those barriers.
Right.
And I'm honestly glad that I thought to do that, to meet people that were outside of my school and outside of the bullying environment, that had no knowledge of the labels. So I had to create opportunities for myself to make friends and to date.
And which I think is the way that we, you know, escape our reality, is to look at, is to look away from the bubble, you know, is to not stay, right? I mean, like we leave abusive households, you know, that we leave. You know, we've heard a lot of stories of people just wanting to go, you know, to leave, emancipate, run away, to just step outside of the pain and of the memory of the pain.
Absolutely.
Of the choice. So not something that I know you talked about. I'm sorry, Bill. I didn't mean to walk.
Go ahead.
Well, it is, you know, how do you all from these bullying environments, you know, whether they be in school, like within the home, the in-laws, you know, like I had mentioned. I mean, it's, and especially the longer you're in these patterns, it's harder to break away from them. But you've talked about some strategies, and so I'm interested to hear, you know, some of your thoughts on that.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Some strategies to step out of the bullying. Those strategies are just what I mentioned. If you're being bullied in a certain environment, like school or the workplace, then do what you have to do to meet people that don't go to your school or don't work at your workplace and make friends out of them. My advice would be not to tell them that you're being bullied somewhere. You know, that's kind of private, and they just don't need to know that. But cultivate relationships outside of the bullying environment, and I promise you, it will keep your self-esteem from tanking. You may not have any friends at school or at work where you're being bullied at, but if you have friends somewhere outside of that, it can work wonders for your self-esteem. And so my advice is to cultivate relationships that can exist outside of the bullying environment.
And so, you know, that's great advice. What about just one-off situations or situations where, I mean, I'll just use an example, and this is part of me just having, you know, being taught, you know, to behave and to conduct myself in one way, meaning, you know, if you're being mistreated, you know, you got to just grit and bear it, right? Or try and pretend like it doesn't bother you. But really, truly, emancipating yourself, I guess what I'm saying is I always thought, even as an adult, even when I got married, that I'd had to go into a situation, even when I was being bullied and mistreated. The pattern that I grew up with was just with stay in the environment and put on a brave face and pretend it doesn't bother you. So I think from what I'm hearing, though, is you don't have to withstand that kind of treatment. You know, you have the freedom to make a choice and to choose
right.
not to, I'm hearing.
That's, you do. You really do. I mean, you can, a lot of time, what you're talking about when you say to grin and bear it, act like it doesn't bother you, I mean, sometimes
mm-hmm.
that works, but sometimes it doesn't. That's why anytime you're being bullied, it's important to stand up for yourself in the early stages of it, when it first starts, because if you let it go on too long like I did and
mm-hmm.
you let it build and then you start standing up for yourself, your status as bullied person will calcify and it will become ironclad.
Mm-hmm.
People will get
mm-hmm.
too comfortable. It will progress to a stage where people have gotten too comfortable with mistreating you. And once they get comfortable with doing that, with abusing you, by that time, if you start standing up for yourself, it does no good. That's why it's important that if you're going to stand up for yourself, you do it in the early stages.
Mm-hmm.
Because once it's progressed and escalated for so long, people get too comfortable with abusing you, and no amount of standing up for yourself is going to do any good, because they've gotten comfortable and they've gotten complacent. It's because the bullying has become a pattern. It's become a habit for them, and habits
mm-hmm.
are hard to break. And once it progresses to that stage, it's impossible to stop, no matter how you stand up for yourself. The only thing it's going to do is make them resentful and want to retaliate, because they've been getting off on that power for so long that they're not going to give that power up.
The best advice would be to just leave the situation, to just find it a completely different environment.
In that kind of case, in a
mm-hmm.
case where the bullying has gone on for so long that you can't stop it, it's best to leave the environment if possible. Because
mm-hmm.
once it progresses to that stage, bullying's like a cancer. You know, if you catch it in the early stages, then you have more of a chance of a cure. But once that cancer gets to a late stage, there's no curing
mm-hmm.
it. And that's what I compare bullying to. You can't
mm-hmm.
wait. You have to treat the cancer in the early stages if you ever want to go into remission and get cured.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. Bill, what are your thoughts? What do you think?
I'm thinking about some other stuff, but I'll be happy to share this with you. I've always felt less than. Less than is a problem that alcoholics have, you know. And I think maybe trauma survivors have too, but I'm both, so I don't know. But one of the things that I feel less than is like the cousin that was a few years older than me, and his mother kept giving my mother his clothing, and I could never wear it. My mother would go and buy me clothing, and we would go to the seconds in a store, or we'd go to a store that was about seconds. And that really bothered
right.
me, too. It's like, I could always see where the problem was on this, on the, you know, on the shirt or whatever. I could tell the seam was, you know, inadvertently, I guess, sewn wrong, or the buttons were wrong, or whatever it was, or there was a hole that they seamed up. I could always tell, and it really bothered me. I didn't see her getting seconds, and my sister and father getting seconds. I don't know. I felt that I was being uniquely treated, and it wasn't fair. But I, you know, I was not a smooth person. I didn't know all these things, like you're talking about dating somebody that's older and out of your area and stuff. Of course, I'm a guy, so this might have been different for me anyway. But
right,
you know, for me, the fix was alcohol and marijuana later, and then, you know, after that, it was it was hash, and, you know, I mean, that's what it was. It was drugs and alcohol, you know, and
right,
and then LSD. Oh, geez, and mescaline, yeah, and peyote. So that was the
right
drugs of the era. Yeah.
Well, I can relate because right before I transferred school, during my when that year started, I was still at the old school, and we had an influx of new students that came in from other states. And so I started hanging out with them, and one of them was basically they were potheads. And
yep.
So I started smoking weed too,
yep.
And I had smoked it before at the Monsters of Rock concert, but when these people came in, we had one guy from Miami, one guy from Chicago, who actually sold dope to make a little money. And so he would bring the marijuana to school, and after lunch, we would go up to what we called the hill that was up behind the school, and we would smoke before we had to go to our next class.
Right.
So, I hung around with the stoners.
Right.
And I'll admit, we had fun. I mean, we would hang out on the weekends. We would go cruising down the strip. This guy would have parties at his house, and we would go and smoke and drink, and, you know, they had house parties. So, you know, I felt accepted with them. Yeah, they were stoners, but when I smoked with them, and any time I was with them, period, I felt acceptance, and it was a wonderful feeling.
Right.
So
well,
I know
me,
exactly where you're coming from.
For me, being a pothead was that was the baseline for my life, and you know, I drank too. But I drank less.
Right.
When I learned how to smoke pot, I drank a little less, so I didn't throw up as often and pass out as often and crash things. And that was, it became a mix. I became a chemist after that. But it was always, it was marijuana morning, day, and night for years for me. Morning, day, and night.
Right.
So I was a pothead and an alcohol and a drinker. But I still didn't feel right. That was me getting as close as I could to feeling okay inside myself, but
right.
It wasn't there yet. But and it never did get there that way.
Right.
But I, I remember I came from a place. I'll tell you a little story quickly. In freshman year of high school, which was 1967, there was one of these instances where somebody was being bullied, and I didn't like it. And we had all gone out on a field trip. The biology teacher, he took us out in the wilderness, kind of, and there was this lake, about 11 acres, I believe, was the lake. And at the one end, there was a dam that held the water in. Not a big dam, you know, 10 feet of concrete or something, 12 feet. And this guy kept bothering the other guy. I said, I'm telling you, you keep that up, and you'll see what happens, you know. So we're in single file. We're going across the dam, the top of the dam, get to the other side of the lake, and he did it again to the weaker kid, and I grabbed his shirt and I threw him in the lake, threw him off the dam. And all of a sudden there was this big kersplash, right? And nobody knew what I was going to do. I surprised myself, kind of. But, you know, everybody looks around, what was that? And it's this kid. And the water was not deep enough at the dam that we had to worry. He kind of stood up and it was chest high. But he was soaking wet, and the biology teacher couldn't believe it. You know? So that's the kind of, I did that, you know. I was in 67 or 68, yeah.
Right.
So, but I mean, I've struggled with feeling different, separate, and unique forever, I guess.
Right. I can relate. I suffered that for a lot of years. As I got older, I got out of that, and now I'm okay with myself. You know, I actually feel good about myself, and I think that's the beauty of getting older for me, is that, you know, the confidence that comes with it. You know who you are and what you want, where that's not so clear when you're younger.
No, I had quite a journey to get here. Quite a journey, you know. I started to say, I think some of my low self-esteem or feeling different than other people, like my family and so forth, had to do with the fact that I've always known I was adopted. And so that kind of explained for me why I didn't feel like I fit in. Because indeed, I didn't fit in. I was accepted into the family. But I wasn't from the family. And you know what? You'll find this interesting, Penelope. I just recently found my mother, my birth mother.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And she's deceased now, of course. But I found her and found her siblings, which are two sisters. And I had some cousins and so forth. And they don't really want to have anything to do with me. Just surprised me. But I guess they felt like I could threaten their security or something, because the first time I found my cousin, I asked him, do you know so-and-so who lived in your town? He said, man, have you hit the jackpot, right? He said, I certainly do. She did this, and she was like that, and she was this and the other thing. The next day when I gotten back in touch with him, he didn't want to talk anymore. So I think he must have mentioned that I had emerged to maybe his mom or you know, who is my mom's sister. But anyway, for some reason, now I have second and third cousins who are actually helping me find information about my mom, and have actually just this last week come up with a series of pictures of my mother. I'd never seen it before.
Oh, my gosh.
And one is as a young woman, she was a young lady. She was in a, looked like a bridal gown, like a bridesmaid gown, with her sister in the same gown standing next to her, one of these two sisters. And then later, a really nice-looking picture. She's a beautiful woman. and then later some pictures from the 90s, when she died in the late 90s. And she was married, but not at the time I was born, so I don't know who my father is, but I'm also kind of searching for that. Because,
wow.
You know, it fills in some of the blanks. Really blank, you know. I didn't know anything until a little while ago. So these are some of the things that, yeah, go ahead.
No, congratulations for, you know, finding your mother and doing that work.
Yeah.
I agree.
I have one particular small group of distant cousins who are helping me. And, you know, my grandfather was from French Canada. He was from Quebec. And he was a Quebecois. You know, he spoke Canadian French, which is a little different. But his wife was, he came down to the United States for work. And he ended up finding a job in a quarry
He was a stonecutter, and married an American woman in New England. So that's my grandmother. That's my grandmother. So I'm a there's a lot of French in me, but there's also some other Western European English and Irish and so forth, and a little Italian. And then there's a group of things that are from the east of Europe, like the Eastern Bloc countries, maybe Poland or Hungary or something like that. And they are not part of my mother's genealogy. So the family on my mother's side did not contribute that to me. It had to be the family on my father's side. So I'm kind of interested in, maybe we can find him. I don't know. Maybe it's a long shot, but it's been amazing to see her for the first time.
I cannot imagine what that would be like. Surreal.
By the way, she's why I had creativity, because she was a creative person. She was a beautiful girl. She had an older sister and a younger sister, and they were all 2 years apart. So my mom was born in 32, I think, and her sister in 30 and another in 34. So she was the middle daughter, and she was the beautiful one. And she went off to have a career in – she danced. She modeled. She might have done some little acting stuff. And, I mean, her dance was kind of creative. It was she did the can-can as a professional and was sent to France to exhibit her American can-can at one point. And I think she she was like a pinup girl in the Korean War. So, I don't know that much more about her, but I'm going to be learning. It's fascinating to me, of course.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is. And so, have you made any headway on finding your father?
No, but to separate the DNA that doesn't belong to my mother's side of the family, I can find her. I went back on her side of the family, back to the 1300s, till the time they started making records, And as I say, it went back. We were early. What do they call it? Colonists. So they came over and when this. This continent was pretty new, and say, but you can go back into the European stuff too, and that's when it goes back to the 1300s. There were quite a few generations I was able to go back, at least on one line, or two lines. By the time you get back there, you got a lot of lines,
I'm
sure. That many generations back, but so I don't have any. I know where I was born. It was in a women's hospital in Manhattan. That hospital has been torn down since then. But the records were all kept, and I was able to get some information from birth records, but it doesn't have my father's name on it. And so I don't know. There's also a boy a year after me who had a similar name, last name, same last name. And he may be a brother. I don't know if she had two kids or just one, but it's possible that she stayed in New York and had a second child. I don't know.
Lay down, Rob.
Yes, ma'am. Find out.
Wow. Well, talk about taking back your power.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But I took us away from the topic. I'm sorry. I got excited.
Not really.
For a moment.
No, I think that's very exciting.
Absolutely. It's we're interested in hearing it.
Well, I'm going to I decided to do this only recently. I'd had the DNA test done and it was a couple of years ago. But I did know my mother's name because I had found it out by the hospital records. Somebody told me. They looked it up for me and said, "Oh yeah." I said, when were you born? And I said, you know, my birthday. And he said, "Okay, so that means you're this child." So that was another hint that there could have been more than one child. Because he said, "Okay, you're this one." and I was looking for my mother's name and the time of birth. This was my first wife wanted to do a chart on me? Astrological chart.
Oh, like a family tree?
No, like an astrological chart for astrology. Like I'm in Aries and I have, And so you have to know the time of birth and the place of birth, and then you can have somebody do your chart. Mm-hmm. So I found out, you know, I was born in Manhattan at 9:03 in the morning. So, it's really interesting. I'm going to, these cousins, distant cousins of mine who I never knew, of course, they speak French. And we're using Google Translate, well, they're using Google Translate on my behalf to write things out in French and then translate them in Google. And it works pretty well, by the way. and so I'm pleased to say that there's a small group of people who are my relatives and friends of my relatives who knew either my mother or her or my grandfather or something like that. You know, they had some association and some distant relationship, and they're helping me. So it's really wonderful.
That's just mind-blowing to me, and I think it's great. I think it's great that you're going after it and getting that information, especially if it's something that you want. So,
I wouldn't have done it. I promised myself I wouldn't go public with my child abuse story until my parents were dead, and.
Yeah.
I kind of felt the same way. I didn't pronounce it, but I kind of felt the same way about searching for birth parents. So I've done both those things, of course. And now my father died just at the turn of the century. My mother in 2000, I think it was 7 or 8, she got Alzheimer's really bad. So that's when I started NASCA. And a little later, I started looking for relatives. For my history.
Well, starting NASA, that was.
Hmm.
So starting NASA, that's going to funnel your creative energy.
I have a lot of creativity in me. It just was never directed. I found that out when I dated a girl who I met at the first time I went to college. She was Mexican. She was in New York City with the Ballet Folklorico of Mexico. She was a professional dancer on the federal level. And she came over with a small troop of kids who were asked to come to the United States to learn modern dance so they could go back and teach it in Mexico. So anyway, to make a long story short, I got invited back to her house in Mexico City, well, to her mother's house. And I, for the first time, was immersed in a family where everybody was creative in different ways. And I was fascinated by this. Her father, who was out of the, you know, divorced from her mom, he was a filmmaker. Her mother was the pianist for the symphony orchestra. She was a fantastic pianist. Her boyfriend wrote contemporary music, which is wild stuff. It's not even written in the same language as, you know, notes that we're familiar with. It's written in, they write contemporary music in different ways. And then her cousin was a guitar player, like a folklorico guitar player. Everybody was creative, and it didn't matter that I wanted to be creative. I finally fit in, kind of, you know. It's like, wow. Blew me away.
Well, it's the way to come home.
I'm sorry, go on.
Well, I've taken up plenty of your time. I'm sorry. We've got 10 minutes left, so I want to make sure you know that and you can use it for however you'd like.
Well, I just love the example that you've given of completely taking your power, you know, taking your power.
I'm actually getting more information every day or two from the one cousin that's coordinating for the French Canadians, and it's amazing. She's been great, and her friends and some other distant cousins have been great. She's the conduit to get things to me, and I'm just so grateful. I knew nothing about me myself. Virtually nothing until like a short while ago.
Yeah, and you know, sometimes just having answers is a reason behind something. And I remember Lisa Zarcone saying that when, you know, having the answers, you know, having reasons helps you just being able to process certain life events in a very different and profound way. And it sounds like that's what you're doing. It sounds wonderful, but I can see where it's something that you need to be completely ready for emotionally.
Well, I know a lot more than I did before. And she did die in the 90s in Florida, by the way. And she had a brief marriage late in life. I believe it was to a man named Smith, so that doesn't really help very much. but they were in Florida, which is where she died. You know, I think in like 97 or something. Yeah.
That's too bad that you missed out on meeting her in person.
Do I know what?
It's too bad that you missed out on her in person.
Oh, on meeting her in person? Yeah, that would have been great.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have wanted to, unless my parents died first, like I say, you know. I think they celebrated the fact that I was adopted by them, and my sister was adopted by them from another family, but a year and a half later. And we always knew it. Because it wasn't hidden from us. It was, like I say, celebrated.
Right.
We had an extra birthday, which we called our adoption day. And
aww.
We didn't get presents. We didn't get
aww.
Presents, but we often had a little cake with a couple of candles in it. Because, you know, I was 3 months old, and my sister a year and a half later was 4 months old. So we were little infants. And, you know, one of the first things we ever learned about each other for ourselves was that we were adopted, whatever that meant. I didn't even know what it meant when I probably was told, but they never hid it from us. So yeah,
that's
adoption
incredible
day for me is exactly 3 months after my birthday. It's March 26th and June 25th.
wow.
Yep.
Well, that is a real feel-good element to the show tonight. And I do think, Bill, it really does, you know, align with, you know, what Sherry has taught me about really, you know, taking a situation and really, you know, getting your power back and the decision that you made, you know, what you're doing. You know, you're...
Well, I guess that's why I shared it, because I kind of felt that way too. I felt like the story of the show was a lack of power, and how do you get it back, or how do you get it at all? Yeah.
Right.
Well, I can tell you what worked for me is to become the person that I needed and didn't have, and I think that's how I got back my power.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Yep. Wow, that's incredible. It is a lot of fortitude.
I'm still, you know, I'm still learning. I'm still learning. I'm still, you know, noticing patterns. I feel like I've, you know, come a long way, but the bullying that I was exposed to was, it was across, you know, different, and it lasted, it endured for decades and decades. But there, it's not one big dose from one entity. It's smaller doses from several. Not to say that they were less, you know, impactful. They were very impactful. But you know, we all have a way of, you know, especially being in recovery and being able to, you know, wanting the awareness is that's a germ part of the journey.
Right.
That's right.
And we're lucky that we have you, Sherita, to help us do that. Especially with the bullying.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That means a lot.
I couldn't agree more. No, we were saying before you came on the show tonight that how much we appreciated between each other, how much we appreciated your being a part of NASCA, and we were looking forward to your, you know, coming on. So, you know, it's certain people are really we know are committed to. You know, helping others, helping themselves, but helping others too. And we're glad that, you know, you stepped forward when we were putting this kind of show together and volunteered to be one of our co-hosts, one of our hyphenates. So thank you very much. God bless you.
You're very welcome, and God bless you too.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Sherita. We are very, very, very fortunate to have you, and you know, I echo all Bill's sentiments about what he said. And the knowledge that, you know, every time we do a show, I learn, and what I learn is, you know, some of my situations of bullying may, you know, have passed because people have, you know, I moved away or people have passed away. But what I learn is something that I share with others, you know, from you. I share with others. I share with friends, I share with fellow NASCA family members, and most importantly, I share with my children, because I definitely want those patterns to be, you know, addressed, and I want them to
absolutely
have the wherewithal. Yeah, they can teach their children. So it's definitely I'm changing the cycle, and I'm transforming, you know, the cycle into really something else, something positive and empowering. So thank you
for everything. You're so welcome, and I'm so proud to hear that. I'm so proud to hear that you're learning and you're transforming into a more positive person, because abuse can make you so negative. It did me for a lot of years. And, you know, once you get that power back, the negativity seems to, I wouldn't say disappear, but it definitely lessens a great deal.
Absolutely. It can be mitigated. And that is, I think, the whole point of the recovery, right, and what NASCA part of NASA's mission. So I just want to thank you so much for being a part of it. I want to thank also, you know, my co-host and trailer, Bill, for coming on. And we have
my
about
pleasure.
5 seconds. So I'm going to sign off and say thank you.
I want to thank y'all too, because, you know, you guys are doing the same for me. You, Penelope, and you, Bill, and Annie, and you know, you do the same for me. You know, I learn a lot from you guys as well. So, you know, it goes both ways. So thank you. Thank you, too.
Oh, my gosh. Thank you. You're welcome. You're welcome. That's beautiful. Well, thank you. It's been just a great show. The show will be archived on our website. This is scan number 3052. Thank you to Cherie White and for Bill Murray. And with that, I say good night. Thank you.
Thank you. Good
night. Another tomorrow. Cause that dawn was you are forgotten after all that you've done.
Blog Talk Radio.